Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Many people's dream career is to make a living as an interviewer, especially interviewing some of the world's most interesting people. Well, my guest has done that. He is the longtime host of Q&A on C-SPAN, in which he's had countless in-depth interviews of the likes of Isabel Wilkerson, Christopher Hitchens, Michael Lewis, Malcolm Gladwell, and Charles Krauthammer. His new book, Sundays at 8, subtitle 25 Years of Stories from C-SPAN's Q&A and Book Notes, another show he hosted, consists of essays that distill 41 of those interviews, and he now joins me. Brian Lamb, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Good morning, Marty. How are you?
I am well. I've been looking forward to talking with you. I'm supposed to be the dispassionate journalist type, but I've been a long fan of your crisp, intelligent style of interviewing and have been particularly looking forward to having you on the show.
Thanks for being interested.
Good. Okay. Well, let's talk about the personal impact of your interviews on you. Is there at least, let's say, one person that you have interviewed whom you recall actually changing your life or at least your worldview?
Well, the two of them that come to mind, I mean, there are many, but two of them that come to mind that had a direct impact on me are two historians by the name of Richard Norton Smith and Doug Brinkley. Richard Norton Smith, because when I interviewed him, he talked about presidents and told a story about how, since he was 8 years old, he had drug his parents to all the grave sites of all the presidents in order for him to go on vacation with them, which sounds kind of odd. So I followed up and did the same thing. And Doug Brinkley, because he introduced us to something called the Magic Bus, where he took college kids all over the United States and introduced them to American history by going to places where things happened. We took that idea and made our own school bus out of it, and we still have a bus on the road 20 years later going from school to school. And so that's just two examples. There are many others.
Yeah, you said you actually went to gravesite. Tell me about what your own visits to gravesites and why and what implications it had for you or what impacts it had on you.
Well, I'm not a great student. I haven't been in my life. And I'm much better off when I see something or I hear something rather than I've learned how to read, but it wasn't when I was in college that I was doing that well with it. And by going to the different grave sites, it forced me to learn about the individual presidents. And by the way, it was the challenge, of course, just the fun of challenging Richard, who's become a good friend over the years, to being able to do what he had done. And I will never become anything close to the historian that he is. I did follow up on that, and I beat him at one. This is the only time I beat him at anything, and not that I'm trying so hard, but I am. I like competition. I went to all the vice presidents.
Oh, wow. Right. You know, what I found just interesting about what you said was that, you know, you were never this great student. You weren't this great scholar. People would think that, you know, preeminent interviewers like you or Barbara Walters or Charlie Rose or, you know, any of the great interviewers would have to be this wellspring of reading and knowledge and intellectual genius to be able to summon up on command the brilliant questions and comments. How did Brian Lamb actually end up having this one of the preeminent interviewing jobs in America?
Well, a lot of it was by default, although probably in the back of my mind I wanted to do it anyway. But when we started as a network back in 1979, we didn't have any cameras or equipment or, for that matter, any on-air personalities, and we don't call them personalities, but anybody that could go on air and communicate. And in 1980, we started the first national television call-in show, and I was there, and I had been in radio and television early in my life, so I just jumped at the chance, and it started out kind of like, let's do this, let's see what happens, and it caught on, and I've done it for the last 34 years.
Yeah. You know, Brian, it really does strike me that the older I get, the more I realize the power of serendipity, what I call planned serendipity, putting yourself in places where good things are more likely to happen. I mean, if you sit in your house waiting for the pizza guy to bring over the pizza, not a lot's going to happen. But if you hang out at a place like C-SPAN, where there are a lot of smart people doing interesting things, even if you're the mail clerk, but being around that creates the essentially planned opportunities for that serendipity to happen. You buy that?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, if you look at our people that are now hosting on the air, one of them who you don't see as much as you used to is a woman named Susan Swain, who was very much instrumental in editing this book that we're talking about. She came to work for us when she was 26 years old. We paid her a grand, $15,000 a year to be an assistant producer. Today, she's co-chief executive officer and longtime on-air host, and just finished a series on First Ladies and did a really outstanding job. So just by, and I tell this to college kids all the time, and I know you spend a lot of your life coaching people, that just go and do, and don't worry about running the place for the first 5 years after you get out of college.
Absolutely. The book he was talking about, by the way, is it's called Sundays at 8, subtitled 25 Years of Stories from C-SPAN's Q&A and Book Notes. And I am talking with its author and that lead interviewer, Brian Lamb. Because you've interviewed so much, even though you don't describe yourself as this great intellectual, you have certainly interviewed a who's who of the intelligentsia. As I, in the intro to the show, I mentioned Isabel Wilkerson and Christopher Hitchens, Michael Lewis, Malcolm Gladwell, Charles Krauthammer, a million others. How, if honestly, how has your view of that whole corpus, the intelligentsia, how has it changed at all from doing all those interviews?
Well, Marty, when I started out, I didn't really even think about it. I just saw a need to try to develop longer-form interviews on television because we were used to somebody writing a book taking 16 years to do it like Neil Sheehan and then going on the Today Show for 6 minutes
right.
trying to explain it in 6 minutes. We just had the time, and I didn't think about it in those terms. I just said, I was a generalist. I would read the book, and then I would try to pick out things in the book that I would hope that an author could explain to the average person. I never thought about interviewing intellectuals.
But has your view of those people, because you've gotten to meet so many of them in long form, have you become more enamored of the intelligentsia, less just thinking of them as regular people? What, if any, macro conclusions have you drawn about that class, that what they call the chattering class?
Well, I know what my IQ is, and I know what my ability as a student is, and so I consider myself really the average person. And I have an enormous respect for somebody that is a member of the intelligentsia. I must say that more than respect for their intelligence after all these years, I have respect for their ability to work hard and do the research necessary in order to lay down stuff that nobody else knows. And that's, I think, more than anything, what I've learned about the good writers. A guy like Michael Lewis that you mentioned doesn't just sit down at the typewriter and start writing. He's a very good writer. But he first goes and talks to people and fusses over the details. And you never see that about him. He's one of the best interviewers you can have because he's so articulate and he's smart as he can be. And it's the same way with Isabel Wilkerson or any of the people you're mentioning, Charles Krauthammer. They all approach it differently. Some come in with a much larger computer in that brain than I have, and I just have a lot of respect for that.
So you're really talking about kind of three pillars of excellence, is that, yeah, they have to be smart, but they also have to be hardworking, and three, they have to sweat the details.
And the details, sweating the details is something we never see.
You're right.
I love to ask them about it, and I love if they'll tell me about it, but otherwise you never see it. You just see the book show up.
Speaking of the details, you know, you talked about reading the books. What percentage of a given book, if you're interviewing somebody who's probably, and some of these eminent people, you know, I mentioned Douglas Brinkley, he's a historian, written a zillion books, how much actual reading do you do in preparation for a one-hour interview?
Well, I used to do a program for 16 years that had a different title to it. It was the same time slot.
Book Notes, yeah.
It's called Book Notes. And I had a rule, my own rule, that I would read every book. Now, you know, you can't do that. When you're sitting there with a 1,000-page book in a week, you can get to a lot of it, but you can't get to every. But I always said that I read 75% of all the books from cover to cover, and then the other 25%, I would read the majority of it and would touch most pages. And now that I no longer have a requirement to myself that I read every book, I still spend an enormous amount of time with the book and feel like when I go into an interview, I know where most of the issues are and most of the interesting stories are.
Do you, let's turn to actual interviewing. You know, all of us, we're always interviewing, whether we're on a first date or we're interviewing for a job or we're the job interviewer or you're in the media doing interviewing. Do you have one or two core principles of interviewing that may apply to all of us, especially in the workplace?
I was taught when I was in high school, freshman year of high school, by a broadcasting teacher by the name of Bill Fraser in Lafayette, Indiana, about the techniques of interviewing, and it never left me. And I've learned to do this, although at first I didn't do it well, and that was listen. Mm-hmm. When you ask a question, listen. And if you don't, you're going to find yourself, and I've done this so I know what it feels like, and I don't like it, you ask the same question twice.
Right.
the second thing, I guess, in an interview besides listening is keep your questions relatively short.
Mm-hmm.
My style, not anybody else's. A lot of people, and some you know exactly who I'm talking about, will preface a question with a great deal of, they'll talk for a long time. And that's their technique, and that's certainly it's legitimate. It's just that I have a different approach to it.
For the hell of it, I'm going to share mine and any reactions you might have. I do prepare questions, usually about 10 questions for my guest, and I start with the first question, and then I do what you say. I listen my butt off, and I will always try to ask if there's a follow up question that's more worthy than the next question on my list, I'm going to ask it. And then I will, however, and I don't always just interview. I do when I think I bring something to the table. I will preface with my statement, my argument about some point, and ask him to react. What's your honest reaction to my approach to interviewing?
Well, I think it's great. I mean, a part of that I do myself. The only difference is I don't prepare questions, but I do have a list, and usually if it's a book or whatever, a list of items that I want to ask about. The hardest thing for me is that if you know a lot going into the interview, you want to hurry up and get it all out for the audience. And that's always a danger because sometimes some of the best stuff comes right in the middle of an interview that you're not expecting. I'll give you an example quickly. The famous weatherman, Willard Scott, on the Today Show, had a book probably 10 years ago that I interviewed him on, and in the middle of the interview, out of nowhere, he decides to tell our audience that he's an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
He had never done it before, and he brought it up himself, and he said, I've decided I want to get this on the record. Well, that just lobbed into your lap if you're not paying attention, or even if you are, a tremendous opportunity to find out why he wanted to do it and what impact it had on him and on and on and on. So I'm sure you've had that kind of an experience.
Absolutely. I had that with Maury Wills, the famous Los Angeles Dodger great. He, out of thin air, he admitted that he was the guy who was behind all of the notorious spitballs that the Dodgers were accused of. When they, after a strikeout, you know, they throw the ball around the infield, and he would have an emery cloth in his glove, and he would scuff up the ball so that by the time it got back to the pitcher, it would then do all kinds of dipsy-doos. Well, that was, you know, quite a revelation, and if I wasn't listening, you know, it would have been said anyway, but certainly it opened the door to a lot of discussion, so it certainly makes sense.
That's a good one.
Yeah. So, let's... I'm going to deal with a problem that is really, I find, very pervasive on my show, and maybe it's specific to the Bay Area or not. I have not been able to solve the problem of how to have an honest conversation about race, gender, and redistribution of resources. I mean, it's ironic that a number of presidents have called what we desperately in our current attorney general has called for an honest discussion of race, and yet I have certainly failed in being able to do that. Even in debates, my guests on the air are they end up mouthing these politically correct platitudes, and off the air they admit they had to pull their punches. What's your approach to dealing with such topics?
Well, I've had an experience over the last 30 years. I don't do it anymore, but it really is probably the most honest thing I've ever been involved in when it comes to media exchange of information and views, and that's the call-in show. Call-in shows are often, as you know, known as where the weirdos show up and say a lot of outrageous things. Well, I don't ever call them weirdos, but people show up with a lot of different points of view on our call-in show, but we have a fantastically honest discussion. People tell us the truth because they're anonymous, we don't have a delay, and they usually say things that sometimes irritate people. So I'm used to hearing almost everything. And I've heard the anti-Semites call in, I've heard the racists call in, and the beauty of that was you could go right back at them and say, well, explain that further. Why do you feel that way? And before you know it, they're actually being very honest with you. In a straight interview situation where it's just you and somebody sitting across from you, I get it. I find out after all these years, I'd just soon not talk to somebody that's not going to lay down the way they really feel. And so I really, I shouldn't say this, but I try to avoid even talking to people who aren't going to give it straight to us. And that's been a learned experience.
You think people are actually, I have not, it's my own failing, I'm sure, I have not found people who are willing to certainly defy the orthodoxy. It's easy to get people to talk about the orthodoxy, the current zeitgeist is about we need much more redistribution and the oppression of this group or that group. But I've not been able to find people willing to, and somebody in the mainstream willing to represent the other point of view because there's so much opprobrium they're likely to face. Have you had that problem at all or not really?
Oh, yeah. You have it most in politicians who have learned how, except when they get caught, learn how not to say much of anything that will find its way into a headline that will be offensive to their constituency. And so you almost know in advance when you ask them a question exactly what they're going to say.
Yep.
So I'm done it for so many years that I don't have great expectations in that. And I know it must be frustrating for you. I've long since dropped the frustration because I know what I'm going to get, and I don't expect them to be that forthcoming.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. My guest is Brian Lamb. He is the author of Sundays at 8, 25 Years of Stories from C-SPAN's Q&A and Book Notes. And nobody could be more qualified to write it because he was the host of C-SPAN's Q&A and Book Notes. You know, as I said at the top of the show, many people have this fantasy of wanting to make their living as an interviewer. I'll just ask you, any advice for such people?
Yes. Interview.
Say more.
Well, when I was a kid, you know, my mentors would say, just do it. And since I was 17 years old, I took them up on it. And the first big interview that I ever did was when I was the social chairman of the band committee in high school for the prom. And I was playing radio when I was in high school, and we had a little local show on a commercial radio station. And I was responsible for the band. Well, it turned out that most of my classmates didn't like the band that I had chosen. And it was a guy that you may remember was with the Glenn Miller Orchestra and had his own orchestra for years, a guy named Tex Beneke. And I was so afraid that they wouldn't, you know, like him when they got there that I drove over to the small town of Richmond, Indiana at Earlham College and interviewed him. It was my first interview, and I brought it back and put it on the local radio station in hopes that we could introduce the personality of the kids. And from that day forward, from that interview forward, I took every opportunity I could to interview, and I did it on radio for a long time and then did it on television. That's the only way to learn how to interview, in my opinion, is to do it.
Yep. I'll tell you a little story of how I got into radio myself. I've never taken a broadcasting course in my life. My daughter was about 12, and she had a friend over, and they were bored, and, what should I do, Daddy? And I said, you know what would be fun? We have this little dubbing tape deck, you know, a cassette recorder with a $5 microphone that came with it. I said, let's pretend I'm a radio talk show host, and I'm going to interview you guys. So I plugged it in, and I asked my daughter, I said, what do you want to talk about? And she said, birth order. You know, what's the effect of being born first in your family second? I said, great. So we talked about it, and then I said, this came out all right. So I used that dubbing tape deck, and I made two copies, and I sent one each to the two NPR stations in San Francisco, and three days later, I got a call from the station manager right here at KELW saying, well, you're not great, but how'd you like a show? That's how I started.
What was that, 20-some years ago?
25 years ago. October, it'll be 25 years.
Yeah, you know, if you want to interview, the best thing you can do is interview, but it's also the second thing is just do what you did. Ask somebody. Mm-hmm. It's not always going to work out, though. There are a lot of people that would love to have an interview show that they never get it.
Yeah. You know, that reminds me of, I was told that at Harvard, when they do the orientation tour of the new graduates, a new freshman, one of the things they always say is the key to having a successful experience at Harvard is ask for what you want. And when they say no, ask somebody else.
I agree with that, too. Yeah. I mean, that was my experience when I was in the Navy. When they said I could do something and then turned me down to move, I wanted to move from a ship to the Pentagon, I went right back after them and said, you know, you told me I could have this, and now you've denied me this. Let's go at it again. And I didn't really know what I was doing. I just swallowed hard and kept moving, and eventually I got what I wanted.
Yeah, makes sense. Now, I want to move this, make sure this show is supposed to focus as closely as possible on work issues. So let's talk about a couple of the guests who made radical career changes. For example, Dr. Alfredo Quiñones Hinojosa started out as a migrant farm worker and became a brain surgeon. Tell us about him.
Well, he's a brain surgeon at Johns Hopkins, and he came to this country illegally back in the 80s. From Mexico to the United States, went to California and started working in the fields, and then eventually worked on railroad cars. It is a great story about a guy that ended up going to Harvard Medical School, and he spent a lot of time out in California. He was in San Francisco, went to the University of California. He also taught out there, but he's a guy that ended up, he's very smart, and he's a delightful man, an interviewer, and he loves being out front. They made a special of him years ago on ABC back in 2008, and it got such a reaction he decided to write a book about himself, and it's just full of stories about how he got to where he is now. And he went from literally working in dirt to working on people's brains.
Right. So, you know, any lessons for all of us? I mean, obviously millions and millions of people have come here illegally, and not all of them have gone to be brain surgeons. Other than you, the things you said, he was very smart and that he was really eager to be out front. Any other lessons that might be applicable to all of us? Illegal immigrants are not about starting from the bottom and moving up.
Well, I think, and I think I've read enough about your background to know that you believe in this, is that when you start out in life, take your job. Don't worry about at the time you're a graduate out of school as having your life dream come true, but start to try something out. And that's what I did. I had about 10 different jobs before I landed with C-SPAN back in 1977. And you'll figure it out as you go. But first and foremost, care about what you're doing. And then keep your eyes and ears open and ask lots of questions, even though you may not be an on-television interviewer.
Yeah. Speaking of asking lots of questions, I think this is a good time to let our listeners ask a few questions. So, my dear listeners, I am talking with Brian Lamb. He is the longtime, highly respected host of Book Notes First and then Q&A. On C-SPAN, and if you have a question or comment, especially we like to focus about work-related issues because that is the focus of this particular show. If you have a question about interviewing as a career, especially, or any other question for Brian, that's fine. We won't censor you. In fact, hey, Brian, you don't know this, but we don't have a call screener. We deliberately, this is true public radio where people call in and the very first person who calls gets on the air, and we also don't have a delay. So we hear some things in common there, Brian.
Well, I believe in that very strongly, and we've been back and forth on that because people all the time, not every day, not every month, but they start to abuse that, and it gets very uncomfortable when things are said that have nothing to do with politics. It's all language, and it's usually young men on the East Coast who are getting their jollies off of using four-letter words.
I see. Yeah, no, we've been very fortunate. I've not really had that at all. So anyway, okay, dear listeners, let's see you rise to the occasion. If you have a question or comment for Brian Lamb, the phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And while we're waiting for the calls to come in, one of your guests was kind of, very politically different from your typical person who comes on the show. You've had Charles Krauthammer, who graduated from Harvard Medical School. Then he completed a 3-year residency in psychiatry, after which he decided to scrap it all and become a speechwriter for Democrat Walter Mondale. But from there, he moved into political journalism and moved to the right. Tell us about Charles Krauthammer's metamorphosis.
Well, you know, there's a fact in that chapter and a fact in that interview that when I interviewed him, I really wanted him to explain it, and he doesn't always like to talk about it, but those that don't follow him closely don't know that he's in a wheelchair and that he drives his own vehicle to work every day, and he's been getting around like this ever since he was at Harvard Medical School. And when he was at Harvard, he dove into the pool one day, and his head hit the bottom and immediately snapped the vertebrae, and he says in the interview, I knew then that I would live this way for the rest of my life. And he's an incredibly intelligent guy who obviously knew the medicine, knew the body, and the story goes on to talk about how he recovered from that. He was a Democrat. He's now not what you would call a hard right-winger in the terms. I mean, the best thing about that chapter, he defines what a conservative is, what a paleo is, traditional social libertarian. He's a neoconservative, which means that more than anything else, he's a hawk worldwide on America and the way it stands against other countries, often on social issues, which he doesn't talk much about. He's got a different point of view. And he just decided to be a writer for the rest of his life, and he just had a number one bestseller for a number of weeks.
You bet. Let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. My special guest, Brian Lamb. What's your question or comment for him?
Hi. Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes. I hear you just fine.
Oh, good. I'm past 60, and I'd like to have a TV show interviewing mostly young people, because I work with a lot of young adults, and I see that they really need help with just life issues. And I was just wondering, do you have any advice of how I could get started for that? And could it also be something, even on television, that they actually call in?
Yeah. Brian, you want to take that, or you want me to take it? It's up to you.
Well, unfortunately, Marty, I couldn't hear him.
Okay, what she said was that she was inspired by this call, essentially, and wants to have a TV show in which she gives advice, practical advice to young people, even if there was possible to have actually people calling into the TV show. Do you have any advice for her?
Well, if you've not had any experience at all, your best bet is to go to a local cable system.
Right.
They have an access channel, and get yourself your own program and get into it. I mean, I know a lot of people have done that, and they parlay it into a job eventually.
Right. You know that these public access TV stations, and we certainly have them here in the Bay Area, you basically, anybody who wants can get on and get their own show, I believe. Now, I don't think there's any money involved. So it's one of the services that the cable system provides. So that's, I was going to say exactly the same thing. So, and you know, here's a little punchline to it. Whether or not it ends up being successful or goes anywhere, I have found, and this is going to sound a little, you know, cliched, but the process is worth it. Even if two people are listening or nobody's listening, the act of interviewing is one of the more intimate and rewarding experiences of all. So whether it's successful or not, I'd encourage you to take that first step. I agree with Brian. Absolutely contact your local public access station.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. Take care. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco and Brian Lamb. What's your question or comment for him? Hello. It's you.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey. Am I on?
You are on.
Oh, my God. You know what? I love, 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 love this show. I love the anecdotal experience. And I have a whole story myself. And forgive me, I just want to sing my praises to you folks. I don't really have a question about interviewing, but I am, you know, I'm not a Bible studier of the Bible, but there is a line out of the Bible. And it's to the effect, you have not because you ask not. And that is in line with what our guest was just sharing. You know, it takes tremendous courage to just ask for what you want. Because in the light of, well, you know, it won't work, whatever. And I'm 58 years old. I'm right here on 6th Street driving my car in San Francisco. Yeah, and I'm getting feedback, so...
Yeah, actually, your sound quality is not great, so I'm going to say goodbye to you. But the point, of course, certainly, you know, asking for what you want has got its roots in the Bible, etc. You know, I noticed our callers, both of the previous callers, and indeed many of the listeners to public radio are older. Do you find that that's the case on C-SPAN? And, you know, as somebody who's not a kid myself, but I worry a little bit about the audience, about young people not listening to this kind of stuff or watching C-SPAN as much. Do you have concerns about the next generation in terms of how to involve them?
I spend a lot of time with college kids, and as a matter of fact, my alma mater, Purdue, has a Maymaster program that we bring to C-SPAN where we have 16 students, and they're here right now. I actually love this generation. Mm-hmm. I think they're fantastic, and I think they're interested in, not everyone, but an awful lot of them are. And to see a bunch of kids come out of the Midwest to Washington and ask the best questions of all the guests we put in front of them is really quite rewarding. They don't listen to the talk radio at their age, but neither did I. I mean, although I was a radio guy, we didn't have talk radio back when I was in school. So I don't. There's a lot of things I didn't do in college that I do now, and I think it's just a matter of time for a lot of people.
Okay. Let's turn to this. This is quite a liberal station, KAW. It's probably the most liberal station in the most liberal market in America, San Francisco. So I would be remiss without asking you about your interview with some of the liberal intellectual icons. Your book, it's again, for those of you just joining us, the book is Sundays at 8, 25 Years of Stories from C-SPAN's Q&A and Book Notes. And it includes essays on your interviews with, for example, Malcolm Gladwell and Christopher Hitchens and Michael Lewis. Well, Gladwell, for example, is biracial. From your interview with him, did you sense that that affected his work?
He says, I don't know that it affected his work so much as it affected his life. I mean, he's aware because people, and he tells a story, probably some in your audience have heard it, that when his hair is short, people think he's white. When he lets his hair grow out into an afro, they think he's black. and his mother was Jamaican, his father was British. He's a light-skinned, you know, African. No, he's a Canadian American. He's such a unique character. He's so incredibly successful that I don't see race in his writing at all. And you know, he's got a bestseller right now on the New York Times bestseller list, and one on their hardback, one on their paperback. A couple of months ago, he had four on the list.
Wow. Well, can you
there's been nobody quite like him, and he's just he's a very low-key guy, lives down in Greenwich Village in New York City, and just keeps pumping out these successful books.
Right. So because you've interviewed him and you're aware of his other books, is there one idea at least that stays with you, the Brian Land, the human being, that has affected how you function or view the world?
Oh, I'm sure, Marty, there are lots of them. I didn't know much about history when I started all this, and I think that just kind of hit me over the head when I started learning about World War II and World War I, and then going back into the Gilded Age, going back to the founding. I think what I've learned more than anything else the thread through these last 35 years of learning is that we did lay down a template. We laid down the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, and I've learned things like Democracy in America and Alexis de Tocqueville. I had no idea. No one taught me that when I was in college. And we have gone to his chateau over in France. We did a 55-week program on places he went in the United States. He was only 26 years old. And to have that kind of intelligence at that age, I paid a lot of attention to the value of traveling and then cataloging it and all that. So the idea may not be an intellectual idea as much as a process idea.
Yeah, you know, to be fully honest, I've never read one of his books, but we see, you know, this little precis of the core single concept. We're all trying to be reductionistic and get down to the last thing. So blink is about the fact that we make these instant decisions in one-tenth of a second, and sometimes they're wrong, and sometimes very often they're right, but being more careful about your blink decision. Then there was the Outliers book, which was... it takes 10 to 20,000 hours to become an expert at anything. So it is true. I think we're all desperate for reduction to something simple because there's so much data smog, so much overwhelm. Do you get overwhelmed by all the there's like hundreds of thousands of books that are published every year, and then there's the TV media? Do you get overwhelmed by it all? I do.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there are more books published today than ever in history, and there are going to be a lot more, especially when you add the e-books to it. And then on television, there's so much there that you can't even possibly think about watching it all. It's not even remotely possible. It's just thousands and thousands of hours. And I think we as a population, I mean, we old guys, I say me, I'm not blaming that on you. We old guys, if you're not careful, can drown in this because you have to relearn everything. The young kids aren't having a problem with this.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk Christopher Hitchens a little bit. He's the author of a number of books, of course. I read his diary. He had a diary. He wrote kind of thing, Diary to a Young Man or something like that. But he's best known for the classic atheist track, God is Not Great. He had a really tough fight against cancer. And many people find religion in tough times. Did Hitchens?
He says he didn't. However, I think I did the last television interview with him. He didn't die for a year after that. And I interviewed him in his apartment in Washington, and I had interviewed him 25 times over the years. And it wasn't planned that it'd be 25 years. I mean, 25 times. He came on our call-in show all the time, and I'd interviewed him on Book Notes and Q&A. He said he had not changed a bit on the fact that he was an atheist, but in the last year, he never publicly said he would change. He said he wasn't going to. I have a very strong suspicion that he did not change his mind on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, as you've interviewed a bunch of times, what's another memory you have of Christopher Hitchens?
Well, other than the fact that you didn't know, and he admitted this, you didn't know from one day to the next how sober he was going to be when he walked in. He loved to drink.
Huh?
He loved to smoke.
Huh?
He smoked all the time. More than one time I'd walk him out of the building after the show was over, and the first thing he'd do was light up, and he smoked until he got esophageal cancer, and
right.
He knows that that caused it.
Right.
He was very much aware of all that. But I think more than anything was he was willing to change his mind on things. And one of the things, when I first started interviewing, I was always fascinated by the fact that he would admit to being a socialist. Not that I expect mm-hmm. anything else, but
right.
he came out of Great Britain, and his father was a military man, and his mother had committed suicide, and there was a very strong background to Christopher and the things he was involved in. But he learned it at a very early age and loved the philosophers like George Orwell and others. But the main thing about him is that he changed. And one of the last interviews I did with him was on the call-in show, and he said to me, aren't you going to ask whether I'm still a socialist? And I said, okay, are you still a socialist? He said, no, I've changed. And that's just unusual. You just don't hear it very often.
You bet. You know what strikes me? You know, I didn't know anything about Hitchens smoking and drinking, but so often famous people have substance abuse problems, and you would think they are the ones with the best lives in the world. They have influence, they have money, they have adulation, and you would think they'd be the least likely. Do you have any thoughts about why people who are so successful end up disproportionately seeming to have more drug problems than they certainly should? Is it just the pressure? What do you think?
I think it's the intensity, especially in a writer's life and a journalist's life. You know, it's gotten a lot better. I mean, when I first came to Washington, the journalists were big drinkers. You could go to the bars, and you'd see them there at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. There was a lot of pressure on them to make the deadlines and all that stuff. There's actually more pressure today because of the digital and the websites. But I think we've learned over the years that all of this hurts, and all of this will shorten your life. And so people have started to listen. I used to smoke till I was 20, and that's odd, I know, because what do you mean until you're 20? Well, I started when I was 13. And when I was 20 years old, I used to wake up with my chest hurting, and I'd say, this is kind of stupid.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I used to drink. My father sold beer for a living in Indiana, and I haven't had a drink for 25 years. Mm-hmm. And not because I was an alcoholic, because I wasn't. I just said, this is kind of silly. You know, not only does it put on weight, but people act strange and unusual when they're drinking. And so I just got very tired of it, and I saw a lot of it. It's one of those things that makes it easier for people, as you know. Substance often does, especially if they're intense about their day, about their writing day. And so a lot of writers have been drinkers and smokers.
You know, back to the career thing. You know, I don't think people realize, and it may not be for you, but I actually, you know, I feel under considerable stress when I, not on the radio at the moment, but, you know, when I don't have a thin skin, and I do add more to the conversation than a typical interviewer. I do have opinions, and I, you know, and they're not always politically correct. I get incredible hate mail and calls for me taken off the air, calls for me to be, you know, gotten rid of as a writer, and truthfully, every time my email bings and there's a new email, I'm terrified it's going to be a comment on one of my articles that's on, you know, that's going to call for my head. So I feel that pressure. Did you feel that pressure? Do you feel that pressure at all, or is that just an anomaly of mine?
I don't think I do. I guess I sat out there on the set for too many days taking the calls from our callers, and I got used to people saying strange things to me personally about what they thought my politics were, about my appearance, all that stuff. And I kind of got used to it, and it actually used to bring a smile to my face because I thought, this is going to sound a little hokey, but I thought, this is what this is supposed to be. I grew up with New York, Sixth Avenue, ABC, NBC, and CBS talking at me, down to me, never giving me a chance to talk back to them. And if I really believed in what I was doing, they should be able to have at me, and I should be able to take it. So I stopped worrying about it. One of the biggest assaults on me that I ever had in public life was from your fellow San Franciscan, Michael Savage, I'm sure you're very close to. He attacked me a number of years ago and unleashed a torrent of criticism via email of the nastiest things anybody's ever said to me. And I thought that was an interesting experience. So what I did in return, and I'd be glad to know that he would be listening at this moment, I went on the air and read back to the audience some of the comments that were made about me, and I said, I just hope you understand this reflects the audience that Mr. Savage has.
Actually, I don't know him at all. In fact, there's an enormous schism in San Francisco. There is the right-wing talk radio a la Michael Savage, and then there is the NPR, and there could not be a greater schism than even between the hard left and hard right in Washington.
I was joking, Marty. I didn't think...
Yeah, right. I just want to be sure. I know that, but, you know, sometimes listeners are literal. So, like I said, I'm a worrywart. That's why I lost all my hair. You lost your head too, dude.
Long time ago.
Anyway, you're listening to Work with Marty Nemcon, talking with Brian Lamb. He is the longtime host of Q&A on C-SPAN and Book Notes previously. Let's talk a little bit about Michael Lewis, who you mentioned at the very top of the show. He was hired by a prestigious Wall Street firm, but soon left to write a book critical of Wall Street called Liar's Poker, and this year another book on that, Flash Boys. Did you get the sense that his motivation to write so much about Wall Street came purely from his dislike of all its practices, or was there a component of sour grapes that he didn't do so well, and so he left and wrote a tell-all?
I'm not sure. I've interviewed him a couple times, and he's, as I said earlier, he's a really good interview. He says a lot of things. I think more than anything else that Michael Lewis is a writer. And I think he's figured out, obviously he's been very successful, that his writing is what's drawing people to his books, and it's the stories, and it's the people, and the way he characterizes them. He's been, you know, he's on the bestseller list this week. I think he's number three on the New York Times list. Every one of his books is a huge bestseller, and I think he's found that there's a lot of disgust in this country about Wall Street, mm-hmm. and that by writing about the machinations of Wall Street, that it draws people in. But if you go to the books, it's always about people. It's about the way people are manipulating other people. And I think he's so good at it that I think that's what's really motivating him at this stage.
Dear listeners, there's a thread throughout much of this interview, which is the power of stories. Of course, Brian Lamb's book itself is 25 years of stories. But also when he's talking about what makes a good guest, it's their stories. And when a caller called in just a few moments ago, she said, I love the show because of all this anecdotal and the stories. You know, a rigorous thinker would say, no, anecdote is the weakest form of argument. But human beings are much more persuaded by anecdote and story. It's more vivid. It's more powerful. So if your goal is not just to be intellectually rigorous, but rather to be persuasive, you've got to master the untaught art of storytelling. Is that fair?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you can see it. I was this morning listening to three different religious discussions. One of them would be not be called necessarily religious, Barbara Ehrenreich's new book, and also a Christian Scientist on the radio who was telling stories on a Christian Science Hour. And then later on, I was watching Joel Osteen, who is a preacher out of Houston, Texas. And it struck me, you know, one's an atheist, one's a Christian Scientist with an unusual approach to religion, and then one is a basic Protestant. And they at the base of every single one of their presentations, stories. Telling stories so that others would understand why they think the way they do, write the way they do.
Yep. Let's go back to the phones. I didn't have to give out the phone number. They're just all waiting to talk to you. So welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. You're on with Brian Lamb, the author of Sundays at 8. It's the C-SPAN's lead interviewer. What's your question or comment for him?
Mr. Lamb, this is Don from Palo Alto. It's a pleasure to talk to you. I've listened to your interviews for years, and the long format is just wonderful. Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry you're not doing it on as regular a basis as you had in the past, but it was just totally, absolutely enjoyable. The only thing on TV, really, at that level. But I was wondering, your style of interview tends to be somewhat jumping around. So if someone wrote a biography, for example, your first question might be on an incident relating to their death, and then you may jump to the beginning of their life, and then you may ask a personal question of the writer, and then go back to the book, and so on. That's somewhat unusual, and do you have any comment on why your interview style was that way?
Sure, Don. Thank you very much. I mean, you're very perceptive. Although, after all these years, if people didn't notice that, I'd be surprised. And I tell authors when they sit there in the chair or anybody that I'm interviewing to watch out for that, because I tend to do that. I think the reason I do it is we do have the hour, and people's attention span, no matter how much we'd like it to be longer, is rather short. As a matter of fact, when you go to I was a speech major in college, and what I learned about speech making and have studied a lot of it over the years is that the audience will stay with you for about 20 minutes. I think the optimum time, people will tell you, is 22 minutes. And after that, they begin to fade in and out. And if you can't look them in the eye, you're really in trouble. So I kind of approach the interview that same way. It's not the best in the world. It just is the way I do it. And I'm kind of sensing, is the audience getting tired of hearing this particular line of discussion? And that's the main reason I've done it over the years. And now I just do it as a habit.
I see. And would you consider going back to doing it on as regular a basis? Because you have some other good people there, but I really don't think that anyone's taken your place. And I'm just kind of hoping for selfish reasons that you might get into it, get back to it a little bit more.
Again, thanks. Actually, not. And I'd made the decision years ago that I didn't want to be dragged off the set and have people say, get the old man off there. And so I did it on purpose about 5 years ago, getting off the morning show and letting the younger people get out there and do it. And they're younger than I was when I started with the whole thing. And so they're learning. Greta Bronner, who's relatively new with us over, 4 or 5 years, she's been there. She's just gotten better and better. John McCardle, who's fairly new with us, maybe about a year or so, you just watch him get better and better, and he's only 33 years old. So the fact of the matter is you've got to step aside at some point and let others do it, or you'll never train anybody, and they're training themselves, frankly. And I hang on to the Sunday night show that I do just because it keeps me going, and I like
sure.
it. And I've got some audience out there. I don't think it's huge, but it's still worth doing. I'm also 72 years old. There will come a time when I should get off entirely.
Yeah, well, we're not going to let you, Mr. Lamb, so good luck with that.
Thanks, John, very much.
Anyway, thank you very much for the call. What is, as we are all getting older, we do end up having fears, but also hopes and perspectives and thinking about what really is next for Brian Lamb?
Well, actually, Marty, what I really get a kick out of right now is being with students, and not to impart my wisdom on them, which is not there, but just to help guide them to the simplest things we're talking about today, that don't expect life to jump out at you and be successful in the first couple years. Have to ask questions. Have to wait your turn. Because I think in college they don't spend much time, and it's not the intellectual way, but they don't spend much time saying, how are you going to get a job when you get out there? And a lot of the people that built C-SPAN, there are about 55 or so there that have been there over 30 years, and they came in at the beginning when they were 22 and now they're 52, they all learned on the job, and they all came in doing things like operating a camera or doing audio and the simple things. Now they're vice presidents. And we wouldn't have been able to do what we've done without that crowd. There's just a tremendous number of people that have general college degrees, an interest in television. They came in and learned it our way, and then they built it their way.
You know, it does remind me of how much luck there is in the world. Millions of people go to startups hoping it's going to be the next big thing. How lucky that people who happened to show up at C-SPAN at the very beginning when it was nothing, when it was this idea of the cable industry to try to give something back, maybe do a little PR, and that they were happened to be there, and it exploded and became a big thing.
The interesting thing was the broadcast industry really looked down their nose at us when we started.
Really?
Oh, my God. I mean, the idea that we would insert ourselves into their territory that they thought was given to them and that nobody else should have. I mean, there was a real arrogance about the networks in 35 years ago. So these young kids, I'll give you an example. They go out, they'd be on camera, they'd be in a hearing room, and the guy standing next to him would take out his check on payday and say, look at this. I get all this money. I bet you don't get that much money. And they would cut our cords, the lines of communications and all that kind of stuff. So these are people that have been around 30 years watching the way others treated them in the beginning. And it was a tough go in the beginning because everybody was saying, why are you working for that silly cable operation?
Remarkable. And especially it would seem, you know, when I first started the YC-SPAN, it seemed, you know, it was the focus of parody because you were mainly doing gavel-to-gavel coverage of the Senate and the House. What drove that decision to make that what C-SPAN focused on, especially in its early years?
Well, it was a matter of the first thing that came along that the cable television industry thought was significant enough to do and to spend money for was the opportunity to run the House of Representatives gavel to gavel. It's hard to remember that we didn't know much about the House because it wasn't on television. They never televised their hearings until Sam Rayburn left the speakership back in 1971. And so the country knew about the Senate because they were 6 years there. They were stars. The House was just this little body that nobody paid attention to. And when the industry thought that they could put that in the home, gavel to gavel, even though it didn't sound like something was going to be a matinee success, but they thought it would add to the choice out there. That was the first thing that made sense to them. So if we didn't have the House and didn't have the Senate, we wouldn't have the rest of what we do.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, the old joke about the only things you don't want to see are how sausage are made and how laws are made. And then you enable the laws to be observed, lawmaking observed.
One of the interviews I've already got in the can will come out in a couple of weeks is very interesting because I was just out in your town last week. We came home on Saturday a week ago. I recorded an interview that'll be on in a couple of weeks with George Miller, who's a 40-year veteran of San Francisco, and it reminded me of Phil Burton. And so when I was out there, I went over to the Marina area and took a picture of that statue over there, looking down over the Golden Gate Bridge of Phil Burton. And so for San Franciscans, we have a pretty good show coming up in a couple of weeks that I'd highly recommend.
Good. You know, you had said in passing, and I did try to be listening, you were saying to one caller something about, you know, after 22 minutes, people don't pay attention. It's a good rule. My colleague, I guess I should call him, he really is a friend, Richard Bowles, the author of What Color Is Your Parachute, says he's a former Episcopal minister, and he says you don't save any souls after 18 minutes. What I noticed, and I wrote to you in my confirmation letter to your email, what I really like best about you is you are crisp. You are time conscious. You're not a laid-back guy. And I think that adds to the sense that every moment matters. It creates a sense of urgency. Is that a conscious desire to make the most of every minute and be crisp, or is that just biologically, physiologically who you are?
It's conscious in my case for a number of reasons. One of the things is I don't want you to think that I'm ever hostile to a guest. I want you to be able to listen to the guest without me being in the way. And that doesn't always happen. Sometimes it's just incredulous what you hear, especially during this last couple of years of this financial stuff. And the other thing is that when you see me on my face on the, I look like a sourpuss often, and people, it's more fun to be out in public from time to time. Somebody will say, my goodness, look at him, he smiles, you know. But I don't want you to think I'm on one side or the other, and I'm really not. I want to hear what that guest has to say. But by moving it along, it's just tightens it up. It gives the guest, they look at you and say, he means business, we're going to move on. Although I have to tell you, you'll get a kick out of this, Mario, the longest answer ever was from a guy that didn't care what my face looked like. It was years and years ago. It was Dick Gregory, and he took 32 minutes to finish an answer once.
Wow, and you did not interrupt him?
I did not.
Why?
I just thought it was fun. I mean, see how long he was going to talk. He started talking around and around, and it was just one of those things where you love to see how far somebody will go with that opportunity. And we don't have ratings. We don't have anything necessary to lose except people changing the channel. And I figure that if from time to time we let people do that kind of thing, it's instructive.
You know, it's interesting. You say you don't like to disagree. I want to disagree with you a little bit and see how you react. We'll be a little contentious here. You know, I think that if you just are a mirror, too often your guest is just going to play his old tape and say unquestioned his nicely crafted little sound bites. And isn't it fairer to the listener to play the role of the polite skeptic, asking those hard questions?
Yes, and I don't mean to imply that I don't, because I do try to ask. I don't know how you characterize the questions, but if I'm sitting there and I'm listening to somebody on their side saying, this is absurd, they're not getting to the point, or they're not answering the question, I'll come back at them and keep asking them the question until we can get to the bottom of why they think the way they do. It's just not hostile. And sometimes, as you know, it depends on your venue. Some of the people that are paid millions and millions of dollars to be interviewers, it's all about them.
Right.
And that's fine. It's a free country. Do whatever you want to. We just have a different pattern.
The other thing I wanted to question, the notion of, I know there's value in seeing what would happen if Dick Gregory talks for 32 minutes in a row, but my obsession, one of my core principles of interviewing, I'm curious whether you agree or disagree, is that time is a very valuable commodity. It's in our life, and it's the most valuable commodity of our life, but also in listeners' time. So I am obsessively thinking in this interview and every interview, is letting him continue to talk the best use of my listeners' time? So I interrupt frequently, callers often, and guests. Do you disagree with that?
No, I don't. As a matter of fact, I doubt if I'd do that today if Dick Gregory had a 32-minute answer. I don't think I would. I mean, go back to Don's call when he suggested that I jump all over the place. Well, that's part of wanting to keep the attention of the audience, and I think that, for me, I learned that over the years. I was one of these people when it started, and I probably got it out of just being kind of I wouldn't call myself a gonzo journalist by any means, because I didn't ever think like Hunter Thompson did about journalism, but I did like the idea of just kind of throwing it up on the wall and see if it sticks. And when we started as a network, the way we did that, we weren't time conscious at all. And I can remember Susan Swain was one of the activists in the company that said, we got to put this stuff more on a time basis so people can know it's there at the top of the hour and all that stuff. So I really, I started off thinking one way, and I realized reality was something different.
Well, I have to be very time conscious now, because I'm looking up at the clock and the show is over. So, Brian Lamb, thank you very much for giving me part of your Sunday. I really enjoyed it.
Marty, thank you. It was a real pleasure, and thanks to your San Francisco audience. They've given us a lot of support over the years.
Great. The book is Sundays at 8, 25 Years of Stories from C-SPAN's Q&A and Book Notes. I do commend it to you. And that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do 3-minute workovers on callers, and I will talk with Mark Leibovich. He is the author of This Town, an insider's look at political leaders' behavior and motives when the cameras are off. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.